You're listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa and beyond. Grassroots, community-supported, solar-powered, volunteer, activist radio. I threw that one in just for the fun of it. And this is Writers' Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and wonderful mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And hello, everyone. It's we had such a nice rain, that nice, soft rain. My grass just started getting green all at once.
We are recording the show, so if you're listening to us Friday on April 12th, we did this in the fog and rainy day of April 11th.
Uh-huh.
Right. And if you're listening to us on Monday, April 15th, have a great week and a great tax day.
Yes.
We have a very special guest today because probably many of you who are listening from here in Fairfield, and I know we have listeners from all around the world, but if you're listening here in Fairfield, you are probably aware of this upcoming conference being hosted at MUM on April 20th. It's an all-day event with an amazing array of speakers, kind of patterned after some of the TED conferences or the TEDx conferences, but focused on consciousness. And the title of the conference is Our Conscious Future.
Mm.
And Caroline, you want to introduce our guest today who is a speaker at that conference?
Yes, this is Dr. Pamela Peek, and she is internationally recognized expert physician, scientist, and author in the fields of nutrition, stress, fitness, and public health. On stage or in front of a camera or on the radio, she combines her trademark energy, wit, and humor with the latest scientific data to motivate and educate audiences of all ages to transform themselves into healthy living. And this book is The Hunger Fix that we're going to be talking about today. So welcome, Dr. Peek.
Well, thank you very much. I feel quite welcome.
Well, you certainly are. And I believe you are actually coming to Fairfield next week. Is that true?
I'm absolutely coming in, and you can actually see me live on that day. I like to be alive.
We hope.
Yeah, we're definitely hoping to see you live.
Yeah, I mean, that makes all of us. I'm really looking forward to doing something that I enjoy more than anything else. I've kind of called myself an edutainer, which means that I like to infuse my message with a little bit of, as it were, wit and wisdom and entertainment so that it's more memorable. Actually, research shows that when you laugh a little bit and there's wit thrown into any nugget of knowledge that comes your way, that it's much more memorable. The hippocampus, which houses memory, is able to really hold on to that, sustain that. So I tend to use that as a educational instrument all the time. Plus, it's a heck of a lot more fun.
That's why preachers often use jokes.
Absolutely. And it's not even so much jokes. It's just, you know, little twists of how you want to say things so that people really understand and comprehend, and then hold on to that piece of knowledge, because after all, that's what we're really all about. You should be able to walk away saying, wow, I'm going to remember that, and I'm going to incorporate that into what I do.
Well, it certainly makes sense, because if you are entertained, you're paying more attention. You don't get bored. Your mind doesn't wander as much. But the one question that brings to mind is, why is it so hard to remember a joke?
it's very funny. Who knows? Really, seriously, your mind, especially as you get older, has already housed how many jokes already?
That is true.
Yeah, that's true.
In there.
Yeah.
People tend to hold on to it for a little while, and then if they're not really using it on a routine basis, they tend to blow it off. That's why comedians can remember a lot of their work, because they keep using it.
Yeah.
But if you're really not incorporating that on a routine basis, it tends to just go where everything else goes, right out there into the vapor.
I remember one of the first jokes I ever heard that was my grandfather told. And it's true, I do tell that every so often. I manage to work that in. It's the one about the where they were they were up hunting, and they took turns cooking.
Oh, that was your dad.
That was my dad's. Okay.
Was your dad's. Yes. I love that joke. That's great. That's great.
But unfortunately, it's not one that's fit to say on the air. So, Dr.
Oh, well, we'll
kind of
let that one go.
Yeah. You know? So, Dr. Peak, have you been to Fairfield before?
Yes, I've been to Fairfield. I was a host at the Raj with the founders, and Candace Badgett was just absolutely wonderful in helping arrange for me to come on over to the university and meet with some of the top-level scientists and leaders who are really looking very closely at neuroscience as it's applied to meditation and certainly specifically TM, but there have been a lot of, you know, comparative studies done and just looking at the whole issue of why one would even, you know, be interested at all in meditation, especially in today's 24/7, never, you know, stop for a moment and completely, you know, grab and go world.
What, how long have you been interested in meditation?
You know, I've read about it. I had certainly been on top of it for a very long time, you know, as a scientist, and I've always felt that that there was clearly something there, and I've stayed on top of the science. But, you know, as far as my own, you know, personal journey with that, well, you know, it started really stirring up a little bit when I became the first senior research fellow in the Office of Alternative Medicine at the National Institutes of Health. And that happened serendipitously because I was already in an institute doing molecular biology, and I happened to meet the very first director of that office at the NIH, Joe Jacobs, another physician. And, you know, we became very good friends, and eventually I became a fellow there as well. And I read the work done by Herb Benson, met him, and he's a good friend as well, and certainly met many other people in the meditative field, and also the prayer field, Dr. Larry Dossey and others. And we really started honing in on what this really is all about. You know, taking it out of the earthy, crunchy place and really applying some science here and saying, well, what goes on in the brain? We have new tools now to be able to peer into the brain, and so this made it much more interesting. But still, I myself, as an athlete, would really use meditation primarily as something I do when I'm running or hiking or whatever. I tend to combine it with nature, etc. It was a different experience for me. It was more of a moving meditation, as it were. And prayer was very important to me as well, sort of generically. But I had heard of TM. Lord knows I have 3 degrees from the University of California at Berkeley, and so I certainly knew of TM, but I never was instructed and I never practiced it until Dr. Norman Rosenthal, one of my dear colleagues from the National Institutes of Health, showed me the galleys for his book Transcendence,
right,
and asked me to read them, and of course we always exchange quotes on all of our books, and said, would you please do that? And that really, to me, was the changing moment. He had asked me to really consider TM as he was looking at meditation per se in the book the year before when he was beginning the work with the book, but I was just too busy. I was hosting a couple of shows in the Discovery Health Television and basically running the old 24/7, you know, work week, and with extensive travel, and I had a scheduled breathing, so the very thought of taking some time off to do all of this really seemed to be above and beyond, until I read that galley a year later, and that was roughly 4 years ago.
Wow.
And I decided then to go to the Bethesda TM Center here. I'm in Bethesda, Maryland, and meet up with people that many of you know, and that is Linda and Mario, who are the leaders over there, the directors of the center. And I remember coming into the entire experience with trepidation, and I actually laughed. I had just come off a triathlon, and I think I grew hair on my chest with that one. it was quite an experience. And I came in, and I said, well, look, you know, I'm not going to be lighting candles, and I'm not going to be blowing incense everywhere, and I don't want to hold hands with anyone, and I'm not sharing. So, you know, if this is one of these Oprah experiences, I'm out of here. And they just laughed, and I said, I don't want another... religious experience. I already had one. And I just, you know, what I'm really interested in is this whole thing of understanding what this transcendence is. And so they smiled, and Mario stood up, and he says, Dr. Peake, we have done due diligence with you, and we've decided to call your particular meditation a little customized one. We'll call it Warrior Meditation. I just laughed, and I said, oh, okay, we'll go with that. That sounds good. And so it all turned out to be a good thing. Uh-huh. And it was one of those experiences where when they explained to me, you know, what happens at the conscious level and then the subconscious level and what restful alertness is really all about, I found all of this to be quite compelling, especially the analogy with sort of the, you know, scuba diving as you're kind of coming down below and those, you know, when you hit 30 feet of water and then 60 feet of water and as you're, you know, that whole analogy and metaphor with transcendence made sense to me since I, you know, I live in the water too. And I was one of the lucky ones because I got it almost immediately. Mm-hmm. And it really, I really felt as though this was truly something that would be very, A, useful to me, and B, now I began to understand what that transcendent experience was. And then, most importantly, I started saying, well, if it's this calming, if I could find that place where creativity is heightened and mind integrative thinking is also enhanced, well, I wonder if this would work with my patients, which is when I began to set up a couple of pilot studies with my patients who had food addiction, as it was related in my book, The Hunger Fix.
Wow. Well, there's so many things I'd like to respond to that. First, for our listeners, if you're interested in learning more about Dr. Rosenthal's book, Transcendence, we did interview him on Writer's Voices, and that should be available on the KRUU archives at KRUUFM.com and at writersvoices.com. Wonderful guest, very interesting book. But the next thing that I'm curious about, Dr. Peake, is have you gotten any pushback from maybe your more traditional colleagues as you're sort of venturing into this new field or old field?
I'm a fairly well known for my whole approach in integrative medicine, which of course now is openly embraced by everyone, thank heaven. So I think I'm benefiting by the timing of all of this, and that is that most of my colleagues now understand that something like meditation per se is exquisitely important and should be incorporated into any integrative medicine practice. 20 years ago, I would say no. I would say that there just wasn't enough, and people were blowing it off as some earthy, crunchy experience, and who knows. But I think that now there has been so much written. There are so many excellent studies out there now, and my colleagues indeed are now embracing it themselves and using meditative practices and recommending them to their own patients. So, no, I really haven't gotten anything. For that matter, I don't get pushback at all. I usually get this, gee, I wish I was doing it myself. Or, you know, I've been struggling to find the time to be able to do it, et cetera. It's more like I'm really trying to make it happen. It's hard in the real world. And do you have any great ideas and tips for me? That type of thing. So I'm very, very fortunate now. And I think Norm Rosenthal and I, as his colleagues, have both realized that, you know, this has been very much openly embraced. We're now understanding that there's more and more good research coming down the pike that helps validate a lot of this as well.
So how did you squeeze this into your extremely busy schedule?
You know, it's one of those things where people say, I can't find the time. That's the wrong verb, make the time. You see, as an athlete and someone who really espouses healthy living, right? You have to make the time to have that breakfast, right? You have to make the time to take that walk. This isn't just something that happens, you know, just casually, like, well, we'll just wing it. Because people who wing it live a life like that, too. And they feel it, and they're going to also suffer the consequences of winging it. And does it take a lot? No, it's a matter of priority. How important is it for you to be able to address your overall well-being, starting with your head? And people, I think, get it with the nutrition piece. They get it with, you know, getting up and being more physically active. I think the third component, because I always call the mind, mouth, and muscle, is the mind. People just blow it off. Well, I'll get to it, you know. And now they're realizing, slowly but surely, that the mind controls all. The mind is the center of this. The rest of this is just top-down technical. So you're not going to eat well. You're not going to take good care of yourself physically if your mind is not engaged. Your mind has to be peaceful enough. It has to be at a point where you get it, where you make it that connection. And you cannot do that if you have, if you're on a gerbil wheel mentally. It's what I call the mental Cuisinart, where you're just hit high and spin and let it rip. How can you possibly sit down, strategize, organize, and call upon your prefrontal cortex, the smarty pants part of the brain, to be able to help you understand how to make those kinds of decisions, like making the time? So for me, it turned into what physical activity is for me, and that is, if I don't do physical activity, I feel terrible. I don't feel right. I feel out of balance. I mean, even just taking that walk with my wonderful dog, you know, I miss it horribly if I can't do it. And so it finally spun into a place where if I don't do it. So when it came to TM, I found, you know, that in my meditative practice, if I don't do it, I miss the bliss. I like saying that because it makes me, you know, as you get older, you rhyme everything so you can remember it. So I miss the bliss. It's a wonderful place where no one else can bother me. Mm-hmm. And I've gotten really good at it in the sense that I could really make it happen no matter where I am, whether it was a horrible delay like I had yesterday trying to get in from Chicago back to Washington because of storms and everything, and I was on the plane super late, I was able to do it right there. It was nice and quiet, put on my headphones, called it a day, and it worked like a charm, because I've gotten good at it. I find that if I just make that time, and it's a priority to me, it's not a big deal.
Well, thank you. You're listening to Writers' Voices. Our guest today is Dr. Pamela Peek, the author of The Hunger Fix, among many other books. And in fact, Dr. Peek, let's turn to your career as a writer, which I'm trying to figure out how in the world you find you made the time to write these books with everything else you've got going on. And what made you decide to become a writer?
Everyone is gifted with something that, you know, they can give back to the world. I'm all about giving back. And I found at an early age that writing was very easy for me, that I derived tremendous pleasure from it. And it was my way of expressing myself both personally and professionally, and I found it to be a great way to reach out to people. So I wrote, you know, in addition to academic work, which is a whole different kind of writing, I found that when I wrote my first consumer book, which was in the year 2000, it was Fight Fat After 40, it was my sneaky way of getting them all to understand the connection between stress, toxic stress, because I'm a stress physiologist, and what happens to your eating habits and fat and the buildup of intra-abdominal fat, which leads to an increased risk of heart disease, diabetes, and cancer. And so it was really cool mind-body association derived from the laboratory work I had done at the National Institutes of Health. But my way of roping them all in was to call it Fight Fat After 40, which is why it became such a huge seller. Because I got them all in, reined them all in. They said, yes, I do want to fight fat after 40. Then it was the aha moment. Wait a minute. The toxic stress in my life is really getting to me. And then, of course, even as early as 2000, I had definitely written that meditation was terribly important. Even though we didn't have hardcore, big-time science at the time, I just knew it was a good thing. And then in all my subsequent books, I have 3 New York Times bestsellers now, in addition to writing about, you know, nutrition and physical fitness, I always have added the spiritual component as well as really working with the management of stress throughout, you know, people's lives, because it's so terribly, terribly important.
And what drew you to the area of food and food addiction as an area of specialty?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, I've been working in the field. You know, I'm a bit of a mutant, because I was a traditionally trained physician, but traditionally trained physicians are never taught anything about nutrition or physical fitness, so go figure that one out. The good news is things are changing ever so slowly, but at least, you know, we're going in the right direction. But what I found myself doing was, after working for a number of years in critical care and trauma, I said to myself, this is ridiculous. You know, here I am working with keeping people alive with nutrition, and yet I was never even given a formal course. So I went back in academia as a Pew Foundation postdoctoral scholar at the University of California, Davis, which is the largest PhD program in nutrition. And I became one of the first physicians formally trained in this, especially as it's related to patient care. And I found this to be one of the smartest things I ever did in my life. After I did that at Davis, I went to the National Institutes of Health as a... After I went to Davis, I then went to the National Institutes of Health, and in the laboratory of Dr. George Crusoe, one of the greatest names in stress physiology, I started putting together the stress-fat connection, and that is certain types of stress, what I call toxic stress, those kinds of stress that we perceive with helplessness, hopelessness, and defeat, really do alter our distribution of fat in the body, preferentially piling on fat deep inside the belly, increasing your risk for heart disease, diabetes, and cancer. And after I'd done all of this and published the some of the earlier consumer work and academic work in that, I noticed something for years, and that is that my patients were all beginning to sound like little junkies. And this was really beginning to increase in intensity over the last probably 15 years. And that is, they would all say things like, you know, I need a fix, I need a hit. Withdrawal is just really hard. And I kept thinking, what are we talking about? And they would say, I'm hooked on this stuff, I'm addicted. And I said, is this a methamphetamine, cocaine, alcohol? Where are we going? And they said, no, it's a cupcake. Pizza or creme brulee, and I thought, well, now, you know, and then there would be this awkward, oh, that's interesting, and at the same time, I myself felt it with certain foods, and it tend to be the more sugary foods, but people would talk about the sugary, fatty, salty food combos, and these are the hyperpalatables, we call them, and so my colleagues and I would all talk about this and kind of look at each other saying, I wonder if there's something there. Lo and behold, the answer is absolutely there. Food addiction is real. And we have a hero, one of the greatest scientists in this field, who led the way. And go figure, Dr. Nora Volkow, who is now the director of the National Institute of Drug Abuse, began researching this way back in 2001. Why? Because she's a chocoholic. And she wanted to understand why on earth this was going on with her, and how interesting that was. She found it interesting. With the use of PET scans, these are positron emission tomography brain scans that we use with radionucleotides to light up certain parts of the brain, in addition to functional magnetic resonance imaging, or MRI brain scans, which allow us to look real-time at something that's going on inside the brain, we had now tools to peer inside the brain. Lo and behold, we found that across the board, whether it was, you know, that cupcake or the hyperpalatables, meaning sugary, fatty, salty foods, or whether it was methamphetamine, cocaine, alcohol, gambling, even sex addiction, the same thing was happening in the brain, especially in two parts of the brain. And this really started to impact on, you know, where meditation would fit in, because one of those places was the prefrontal cortex, or, you know, the brain CEO, where executive function takes place, or, as I say to consumers, the smarty pants part of the brain, right behind your forehead, tap your forehead, it's right behind there. So we found that the reward center of the brain underwent organic changes in the receptors for dopamine, that one neurotransmitter that is in charge of giving us that sense of pleasure, reward, but only if it bonds with the dopamine receptor in the brain. If we have a delightful treat, ice cream, something nice, and it occurs on just an occasional basis. When I was growing up, I had ice cream once or twice a week only because it's a treat. Then you're going to have an outrushing in your reward center of dopamine, of course, because I'm feeling pleasure. It bonds with the receptors, and I get that perception of, wow, that's cool. I had a great time. Now, if I have a bowl of cherries or berries, I also get dopamine, but it's not at the higher level that I got with the super treat, right? Flash forward now. What if I had ice cream every single day, maybe even two or three times a day, or in, I'm just using ice cream as a metaphor. It could be anything of the sugary, fatty, salty food combos. But what if I had it 24/7? Starting from the moment I wake up in the morning, your brain is overstimulated. That's what happens. Mm. Your brain says, huh, what? Wait a minute. This is too much. I can't deal with this. Mm. And then when that happens, the brain's primal survival instinct kicks in. And what it does is it says, you can't walk around overstimulated. That's not going to work. So it down-regulates the total number of dopamine receptors to help you, so that you don't feel such an uber reward. When that takes place, the good news is, yes, you do not feel overstimulation when you are now exposed to that particular food product. And I usually say science fair project and so many of these things because I wouldn't even, you know, call it food. but, you know, just think Twinkie, science fair project. However, that's also what starts the addictive cycle. That's the bad news. Mm. Because now, one Twinkie or one whatever will not give me the level of reward or pleasure I originally got. Now it takes two, three, four, five, maybe an infinite number of these. Maybe I have to just binge to be able to finally get a period at the end of the sentence. Mm. That's absolutely true of all of the addictive substances that we've looked at, everything again from alcohol to food products to cocaine, for instance, drugs. Mm-hmm. And the same thing happens. We see a down regulation of this. And what I'm going to be showing in my presentation is one of the coolest looking, because PET scans are colorful and they're really cool. And even consumers can say, oh my gosh, it's one of those aha moments. And when you see this one scan, it's jaw-dropping, because this came from Nora Volkow's laboratory. And the moment we saw that the changes that take place in the reward center of someone who is verified as food addicted, and we have a whole Yale University assessment tool that's been validated to do this with, and it looks precisely indistinguishable from the brain of a cocaine addict in comparison to just a normal person, is jaw-dropping. That was the groundbreaking moment when we all said, oh my gosh, this is real. So my job was then to take this to everyone out there, but that it didn't stop at the reward center. You know, we were all excited. We want to say something. We want to tell everybody about this. But at the same time, we also looked at the prefrontal cortex. And lo and behold, we found yet another huge organic change that when you are in a full-out addictive state, you're out of control, that you have impairment of prefrontal cortex function because of actual organic damage to the prefrontal cortex. You could actually see it on these PET scans.
Wow.
You could see a deactivation of the orbital frontal cortex, the smarty pants part. So to walk up to someone in a full-on addictive state and say, oh, come on, grow up, just use a little willpower, is really tantamount to saying, would you like to run the Boston Marathon on Monday with two broken legs?
Wow.
Okay? And, yeah. You know, I ran it last year, and I have empathy. And, you know, running it on two good legs was hard enough, let alone on broken legs.
With
but,
no training.
You know, is this an excuse for people not to, you know, take control of this? Absolutely not. If anything, it's a call to arms and legs to detox and go into some form of recovery. Just know whatever those substances are, they're not working for you.
Mm.
Because any substance on this planet that you know, consume, either as a drug or any substance you're exposed to, that leaves you with a sense of feeling out of control, then it's not working for you.
That.
And you can live without it. All right? Now, it's easy enough to say that about cocaine. There are no redeeming qualities about a cocaine. I'm so sorry. Right? or methamphetamine, for that matter.
True.
And so it's easy to blow that off and say you'll never have to see that again. Food is a monster challenge.
Mm. Oh, yeah, because you're surrounded.
Well, the science is, it's not the consumption of the food that's actually the problem at the end of the day. Because I just told you, the consumption of the food is nowhere near as pleasurable as it was originally. It doesn't give you anywhere near the pleasure. It's actually the cue, the actual cue that you, when you see billboards with, you know, eat this, when you read magazines, when you hear it on the radio, television, it's everywhere. The cues are what light you up. I'm not even kidding you when I tell you I was walking through Chicago's O'Hare, waiting for yet another interminable delay, and I just wanted to get up and walk a little bit. And as I was walking down one of the aisles, I mean, it's just one food court after another one there. It's a food frenzy at all these airports. But there was this one particular sign that was haunting. And it said, soon, soon you'll be there. Keep walking. Can you smell it? Can you taste it? It'll soon be yours. And then underneath it said Starbucks. And sure to form, I mean, I walked right around the corner, and there was just a line extending who knows how long, and half the scones and all the hyperpalatables were gone, because it was in the middle of horrible delays. There was a big storm going on, and people were stressed out, and of course where they were going was to basically consume, do their little stress eating thing. So now you have a hammered prefrontal cortex. You have a organic changes happening there and the reward center. What are you to do? Well, you do the same thing that you do for any addiction.
Wow.
Any addiction. And that is you have to detox off this stuff, and you have to now substitute what I call substitute healthy fixes for the false fixes and the lies that go along with addiction. And then live a life of wonderful recovery and enjoy and bliss. But how do you do that when literally from the moment you wake up in the morning you step into a battlefield of cues? Well, you need to have a peaceful mind.
Ah.
And so I decided to do a little pilot. Now, it's interesting in 12-step programs per se, and they are one alternative, not necessarily the alternative at all, but one alternative, because there's plenty of really interesting programs out there,
right,
to addressing the issue of addiction. And The 11th step, which was written a million years ago, believe it or not, is meditation.
Oh, interesting.
Yep, the 11th step was meditation. And people blew it off like, yeah, well, thanks for sharing. And then they kind of, you know, went off to the other places. Well, I thought, well, now, isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
I decided to use TM in a couple of pilot studies I did with a dozen patients or so, using, you know, just a discrete number of patients of mine who were new at their meditative practice. And it was easy for me, and TM, by the way, for scientists is a wonderful thing because it's easy to study. You know, it's a very discreet way of doing meditation, and with the 20 minutes and the 20 minutes at just a basic level, because certainly these people are not master, you know, meditators here. And so, for me, it made my life a lot easier. So what we did was we put them through training, and they did this at the Bethesda Center. And they were all credentialed as food addicts through the Yale University Food Addict Scale, which is in my book, The Hunger Fix. And also, on my website, there's a very simple test that we condensed from the Yale University piece, and that's on my website, drpeek.com.
And that's so, P-E-E-K-E.
That's P-E-E-K-E.com.
Yes.
And you just go to the food addiction page. So, what we did was, you know, for a period of 6 weeks, I put them through their little drills, and they, of course, you know, read the book and were following the program, you know, going through their 6 weeks of detox and beginning to enter recovery, which means they've really been practicing all of the things they need to do, mind, mouth, muscle, enough. And this is basically what it all boiled down to, what I found in a pilot study, because quite frankly, no one had ever done this before. No one. Why? A, food addiction's brand new. The food addiction science is just brand new. And B, no one had ever applied this particular form of meditation. And I really, again, wanted to use a form of meditation that was a discrete one that everyone understood, that was more structured, versus what people oftentimes write off as meditation. Well, today I had a blissful moment. Well, that's nice, but I can't study that. I need something more structured. And so this is what we found. Indicative of all addiction is the difficulty adapting and adjusting to life's stresses without knee-jerking into self-destruction. And what we found was that people were able to do something I have now called pausing. And what they do is, instead of impulsively reaching for something when they were stressed out, especially because they were impulsively going back to their fix, they needed the fix. No different than someone who needs to light up a cigarette when they're stressed out, or have that drink of alcohol, or have that hit of whatever drug, right? But what they found themselves doing, and it surprised each and every one of them, was it's like someone hit a pause button in their brain. And they stopped, and they thought, and they started making a connection, ever so brief. And it would be, if I do that, this will occur. Whereas impulsivity, which is controlled by the prefrontal cortex, it negates all of that. I mean, you just go for it. But instead, there was this moment of, wait a minute, let me think this through. And they were absolutely astonished at that. Also, the other thing they noticed is they were more calm throughout the day. Ergo, by doing that, you nip it in the bud. Because then you don't have the stress to start with. In other words, you don't feel so out of control. Because out of control yields more out of control.
Oh.
And so they began to make these connections. And they noticed that it was easier for them to make the right decisions. And this was true of men, women. The grand majority of these people were between the ages of 40 and 60. They were adults. And the mass majority of them have had issues with food addiction for many, many, many years, including binging.
If you're just tuning in, this is you're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Dr. Pamela Peake. She's discussing her latest book, the findings that are presented in her latest book, The Hunger Fix, and Dr. Peake will be speaking at the conference at MUM on April 20th, entitled Our Conscious Future, and the name of your presentation is, what
Ooh,
is it?
Now you're going to like this one, so I'll give you a little hint here. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about the brain, right?
Right.
So the brain is muchos important. So it's your brain's reward center hacked by a cupcake.
And there's a picture of you. Mm-hmm. There's a picture of you holding a cupcake here.
Oh, yeah. Hacked by, well, I use a cupcake specifically because it's one of my little, it's my little crack, as we say in the business.
Yes,
and
yes.
You have no idea, on the cover of my book, The Hunger Fix, there's this, you know, cupcake with a chomp out of it. And that was actually done by one of the cameramen at the photo shoot. I wanted to get the best cupcake, you know, one that made you look like you just want to reach into there and grab it. It looks so tempting. And it took us 20 cupcakes, and that guy probably put on 10 pounds eating all the cupcakes for us at the photo shoot. But it was one of those things that's a metaphor. And,
right.
You know, the biggest metaphor here, more than anything else, and one of the reasons why I named it The Hunger Fix, is that, okay, fine, food addiction is real. Yeah, there's no question we're getting a fix out of this stuff. Come on. I mean, look at the amount of sugar we take in every day and fatty stuff and the salty stuff. I mean, we now understand this. It's very straightforward. All right, that's the first thing. But my overall and overarching theme in The Hunger Fix is, what are you really hungry for? Okay, you're addicted to not just the food, but the entire life that enables this. It's the people, places, and things that you surround yourself with on a daily basis. How do you live? Who are your tribal members? Who are those people, you know, that you surround yourself with? Are they enabling? Are they supporting you in more positive habits? What are you sharing with in your work life, in your professional life, in your home life, in your community life? Where's your personal self in all of this? Where's your spiritual self in all of this? What do you really hunger for? Was it really, you know, numbing yourself with all of this stuff and causing these organic changes in your brain? Really? Or maybe there are dreams and goals you have here that now that you're feeling more peace and bliss, you can actually sit down and strategize to achieve. Maybe that's what's happening here. What are you really hungry for?
Well, Dr. Peake, do you think it's possible to reset your dopamine receptors so that you can go back to enjoying a cupcake once a week and getting extreme pleasure from that?
Okay, so here's the deal. You got to be very careful about this. A, by going into, as it were, detox and getting off the stuff that makes you feel out of control, your dopamine receptor population will definitely rebuild itself to whatever that original was, because we don't know what the original was, right? It'll go back to that original number. And this takes months. This is not one of these ridiculous things you see on TV, oh, and everything's going to be fine in 3 weeks. Really? I don't think so. But you have to be patient with that process. So that's the good news. Now, in terms of re-exposure, I have a whole algorithm for that. Perfect. No, but it's really true. There's a long spectrum of people who have issues with food and addiction. There are the people who are the more lightly affected. And then there are people on the other end of the spectrum who are what we call the cross-addicted. Those people themselves slash their families have a very strong history of more than one addiction. For those people, it will be all but impossible to undergo re-exposure. So if they were really totally into, like, you know, big gooey cheeseburger nasty things like that, the chance of re-exposure without igniting the reward center and causing them to binge and relapse, okay, that's a problem.
Mm. Yeah. Okay.
So for cross addicteds, I would say you could learn to live without cheeseburgers. Okay. Whereas the lightly affected people could have a controlled experimental re-exposure under controlled circumstances, so long as they're now have reached the master recovery level. There are three stages: detox, beginner recovery, and master recovery. And in each one, there are goals that you must meet to be able to reach the next level. And I would say after you've really achieved, you know, a really good sense of control through healthier fixes, mind, mouth, and muscle, and practicing and practicing and practicing throughout beginner recovery, then you could try a controlled exposure. I'm here to tell you that the grand majority of people just tend to avoid the stuff that makes them lose control. Come on. I mean, it's food. There's plenty of substitutes out there for jelly beans. You know? There is life after no jelly beans. You just have to start looking at it that way so that you never feel deprived. Because you have to ask yourself, what am I really depriving myself of? Mm. I'm depriving myself of feeling, you know, out of control? I mean, come on. And you have to really tell your true truth and take it step by step. There are plenty of other things you could be eating, consuming, and doing.
You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Dr. Pamela Peek, and she's been discussing her book, The Hunger Fix, and she's going to give us a little taste of that book. No pun. Well, pun intended.
Pun intended on that one. One of my favorite one-liners from The Hunger Fix is, hand over the chocolate. Nobody gets hurt.
Right. I've seen that, yeah.
And what I'd like to do is read a little something from chapter one, which was called, The Dopamine Made Me Do It. The quote that starts in the chapter is, there is nothing better than a friend, unless it is a friend with chocolate. And this was written by Anonymous. All right. We all have one, at least one, a little darling, a best friend, a helper, a life raft, an entrenched habit that's so comfortable it feels like a hug or an island of calm, a fix. A fix starts simply enough. You think about doing something that you like to do, drink a mojito, or check your iPhone, or get it on with your boyfriend or girlfriend, and that thought lights up an entire dopamine-driven reward pathway in your brain. You feel a rush of pleasure. You start thinking about when and how you're going to do that thing. Is it happy hour yet? Can I sneak a peek at my email during this meeting? Will he or she be around tonight? When are we going to connect? Your brain becomes consumed by the drive to satisfy that urge. You try, but you just can't get it out of your head. You give in. And then as soon as you satisfy the raging hunger, bingo, you feel another rush. Your brain says, yeah, this is amazing. Bring it on. I want more. You need your fix. Most of the time, this neurological process is a good thing. Nature wants humans to stick around, so she uses this system to reward us for doing things that will ensure our survival. Eating food, bonding with loved ones, having sex, making babies, preferably as often as possible. As a result, everything we do, from the time we wake up until we collapse into bed, is driven by reward. We're either getting reward in the short term, enjoying an hour-long massage, or in the long term, earning a college degree after studying for 4 years. The reward can also be to avoid pain. I learned that as a little girl who didn't like to brush her teeth. After suffering through a cavity, I soon learned that my real reward was never seeing that dentist again. This same reward system drives us to learn, to create, to innovate, to pursue our goals. But as a medical doctor specializing in metabolism and weight management, logging thousands of hours a year to educate the public about behavioral change, I've seen firsthand how the dopamine rush cuts both ways. The tremendous high you get from a run in the park, or a hike to the top of a mountain can be powerful enough to change your life. But that healthy high occupies the same pathways and can easily become confused with the dopamine hit from a snort of cocaine or a puff of a cigarette. Clearly, not all rewards are created equal, and some can kill you. In the past few years, I've started to see a growing manifestation of this double-edged sword in my own medical practice. More and more men and women are coming into my office desperate to find an answer to the same questions. Why can't I stop thinking about food? How can a cookie or plate of pasta or bag of chocolates have this kind of hold on me? I feel like a junkie. As I listen to people's tortured stories of unbearable cravings, yo-yo dieting, weight obsession, and emotion-driven stress eating, I've seen a pattern emerge. Their pleas for help are no longer your standard, gosh, I'd love to drop 10 pounds before the reunion fare. Instead, these entreaties have become eerily similar to the cries for help from my patients with hardcore drug or alcohol addictions. I just need that sugar fix every afternoon. If I don't get it, I'll go crazy with withdrawal. I need a dose of pizza. Those Tostitos and dip are like crack to me. Once I start, I just can't stop. I started to realize that in more and more of my patients, these cravings are the result of a reward system gone awry. I had also reviewed the new science that shows the mere anticipation of that food-related dopamine high will cause the reward centers of the brain to light up like Times Square on New Year's Eve, the same as brain scans of cocaine addicts eager for their next fix. It doesn't take much to trigger this cascade of brain chemicals. A casually mentioned word, a picture in a magazine or on TV, or a smell from a bakery is all it takes to awaken the desperate cravings. That same insatiable drive for reward keeps all addicts pressing the dopamine accelerator, overriding their brain's normal satisfaction signals. Okay.
That's great. Thank you, Dr. Peek. If you want to hear more about this and also see those brain scans live and in person, you can see Dr. Peek on April 20th at MUM at the Our Conscious Future Conference. So we're really looking forward to seeing you here in Fairfield for that, Dr. Peek.
Excellent. And I'm looking forward to seeing everyone there. It's going to be a lot of fun. And someone gets the cupcake I'm going to walk on stage with.
Oh,
oh, no.
Oh, no, it's the queue. I've queued you up.
Absolutely. Right. You're going to be a bad influence.
Oh, no, I'm a pusher. You're going to have to forgive me.
No problem.
Right. I'm looking forward to talking to everyone and seeing everyone while I'm out there.
So just kind of a last question before we wrap up here today. I'm really curious as how your books, did writing the books lead to the speaking career, or did the speaking lead to writing the books? And because I understand a medical correspondent on Discovery Health. You've done a number of TV series. You write columns for magazines. Did that all come out of your first book, Fight Fat After 40?
Absolutely not. I actually was discovered for television while I was at the National Institutes of Health when the famous Fen-Phen controversy occurred with the diet drugs. And Eugenia Halsey, the correspondent for CNN at the time, was scouting out someone to talk to over at, you know, the esteemed NIH. And everyone pointed my direction, and I had a microphone pushed in my hand, and they said, okay, you have precisely 4 minutes to explain to the United States of America what Fen-Phen is. And that was my inauguration into media. And it turned out it fit like a glove. And it was an extraordinary experience, and I went on to actually do a tremendous amount of work with CNN, and then eventually on to Discovery as well as the national networks. It's just one of those things I love to do. I look at writing, and I look at my own lectures, and I look at the work I do in multimedia as just simply forms of teaching. These are multimedia platforms for teaching. So they all seem to complement one another. So my my early media career preceded the actual writing for consumers, although I'd written for academics prior to that.
Interesting. And your website is also quite amazing, by the way, in terms of, you know, the multimedia. You've got everything there. Dr. Peek.
Well, we try, please.
Com. Yeah, drpeeke.com for people who want to check that out. So, well, thank you once again for being with us here on Writers' Voices, and we'll see you in Fairfield in a week.
All right, and I'm looking so forward to meeting with everyone out there, so come on down.
All
it's
right.
going to be a lot of fun.
Yes, it is.
And Caroline, do you have some closing words of wisdom for us today?
I do. Don't overlook life's small joys while searching for the big ones.
And see you next week on Writers' Voices. On April 19th, we have Nancy Kennedy, who has a book about inspirational stories about moms.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's great. Okay. Oh, it's a great book. Great
book.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writers Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.